Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. So, how much did last night's vice presidential debate change the race, if at all? The two candidates, Democrat Tim Kaine and Republican Mike Pence, disagreed on a number of issues, but it often sounded like this.
The Clinton Foundation accepted foreign contributions from foreign governments and foreign donors while she was Secretary
of
State.
Okay, now I can weigh
in. She had a private server.
I get to weigh in. Governor Pence doesn't think the world's going so well, and he, you know, is going to say it's everybody's fault.
Do you?
What? The Trump campaign counted up how many times Tim Kaine interrupted Mike Pence. They say it was 72 times, but Hillary Clinton tweeted a Huffington Post headline that she claims says it all. Mike Pence to America. Trump never said those things he said. Well, let's dig in on the day after with Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, although not working for the Clinton campaign. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And Paris Denard, Republican strategist, although not working for the Trump campaign. Welcome to you as always, Paris.
I promise not to interrupt as much as Tim Kaine. Well,
71 times will be acceptable.
But in Paris, I do want to start with you, though, because you have had a rough time recently when we visited. But most polls gave the Republican candidate, Pence, the edge. You agree?
Yes, I think any American who watched that debate performance saw someone who was a seasoned veteran, someone who was on message and who was more concerned about talking specifically to the American people than engaging in this type of negative and type of campaigning that you saw Governor Kaine doing. Senator Kaine. So I think that at the end of the day, the American people responded by saying, you know, it was fair. That he did a very good job and that Governor Pence was the clear winner.
Well, we're reminded that Mike Pence was also for 5 years a talk show host, and some of that polish showed last night.
Jamal, what did you think?
Yeah.
I think it was a epic battle between vanilla wafers and Lorna Doones.
I think one of the talk show hosts said mayonnaise and milk or something.
Or Miracle Whip. Clearly Governor Pence was Miracle Whip.
You know, I think they both represented their side well. They really went at it. I thought that Tim Kaine really pushed Mike Pence on this question that Hillary Clinton brings up about defending all of the things that have been offensive that Donald Trump has been saying. The question is whether or not Americans, you know, how much blame they're going to put on that. What I think really happened last night is we saw the opening bid of the Mike Pence for president in 2020 campaign.
And I want to get to that because that is something that's been talked about this morning. But let's get to this issue of Mike Pence trying to defend or not defend things that Donald Trump has said. The Clinton campaign tweeted out a debate montage this morning, juxtaposing clips of Pence with clips of what Trump had said in the past. Let's listen to a little bit.
Let's start with not praising Vladimir Putin as a great leader. Donald Trump and Mike Pence have said he's a great leader. And Donald Trump has...
Putin's been a very strong leader for Russia.
Vladimir Putin has been a stronger leader in his country than Barack Obama has been in this country.
Donald Trump, on the other hand, didn't know that Russia had invaded the Crimea.
Oh, that's nonsense.
He's not going to go into Ukraine.
Paris, what about that? Does that matter? What do you think of that? That he was saying we didn't say that, but in fact the tape shows that Trump had said that.
I think we have to ask ourselves, what was the purpose of this debate? Was this debate to have the two vice presidential candidates talk about the issues and why they were selected and why they are on the ticket, and to talk about what they will do in support of their candidate? Or was it for them to debate the presidential candidates? You know, this was not a Pence versus Trump debate. This was not a Pence versus Clinton debate. This was Pence versus Kaine. And this is what the Clinton campaign did not want to happen, because they continued to raise the issues about Donald Trump and all the things that he may or may not have said, when the American people, I believe, wanted to hear both of these candidates' visions for the country.
But Paris, go ahead, Jamal.
I'm not sure that people are that interested in Tim Kaine or Mike Pence's vision for the country. Neither one of them ran for president in the primaries. They are interested in Clinton versus Trump. And I think that what we did not get last night was Mike Pence really defending Donald Trump on a lot of the things he said. And when he was asked direct questions, really didn't tell the truth. Just said that Donald Trump never said those things. When we know that Donald Trump called Mexicans rapists, we know that Donald Trump has said bad things about women and talked about what they look like and their body sizes and all that. I mean, we know that Donald Trump has said these things. Has he not said these things?
No, he did not call Mexicans rapists.
What?
Well, he said it in his opening when he started his campaign.
I will always push back on that. What he said was he believed that the Mexican government sends over people that are rapists and other things like that. He also went on to say that they are good people.
And some of them might be good people.
He said some of them, I assume, are good people.
But he did not say that. Mr. Trump did not say in his opening statement that they are rapists that come over. That's not true.
I think you're parsing that.
Well, and this really, I think, is important because we're still debating about something, what it means, something that Donald Trump said when the campaign began. And we're just weeks away from the election.
I believe that's because the Clinton campaign doesn't want to talk about the real issues.
Well, perhaps, I mean, Jamal, your thoughts on that. Is it because does that still linger, the things that he said?
Of course it still lingers. I think that Parrish just said Clinton doesn't want to talk about real issues. Hillary Clinton has issued more policy papers, has put out more programs on paper. You can go to her website right now and see more policies. Donald Trump doesn't put out policies. Donald Trump makes statements and speeches, and those statements may not even hold up by the end of the day, depending on who's asking him questions, which does make it tough for somebody like Mike Pence to know what to defend because Trump is all over the place. It's hard to know where to start with the guy.
One of the most tweeted moments of the debate was Mike Pence's response to Tim Kaine in the middle of a discussion of abortion. Let's listen.
When Donald Trump says women should be punished or Mexicans are rapists and criminals,
I'm telling
or John
you.
McCain's not a hero, he is showing you who he is.
Senator, you whipped out that Mexican thing again.
That Mexican thing. Paris, what did you think when you heard that?
I just thought it was an unfortunate statement that was taken out of context, but it was delivered wrongly. Look, these people are under the gun and they say things that don't sound right but have no malicious intent. Governor Pence had no malicious intent in the statement that he made there. As juxtaposed to the statements that Secretary Clinton has made about baskets of deplorables and living in basement and being Sanders supporters being basement dwellers. I think that was malicious.
Well, some of them are deplorable. And if you tell me that 50% of them, you don't believe that 50% of Donald Trump's supporters are deplorable?
So then tell me what
percentage of them are deplorable?
But Jamal,
the same amount of the Clinton supporters who are deplorable.
Some percentage of them are aligned with David Duke. Some percentage of them are.
But Jamal,
in the
wasn't that Kane's job to say last night, and he didn't. He missed that moment. He did not point that out. You could list the names of the white supremacists who support Donald Trump. He didn't.
Yeah, and I think the campaign is missing a beat by not going harder on that. But, you know, that's Tim Kaine's style. I think he is, he's a moderate politician from Virginia, which has been, you know, he was elected and reelected, so he's people like him with that style. But this is a harder edge campaign. You know, I kept thinking while I was watching that, what if that last night was Elizabeth Warren versus Chris Christie? Could you imagine the fireworks on that debate stage?
Paris, what about what Jamal was talking about earlier, and this has been reported today, that Donald Trump was not happy at how well Pence did last night because it upstaged him, and the idea that he was maybe setting himself up for a run if they lose the election this year in 2020.
I don't think there's any truth to that. I think what it actually showed was Mr. Trump made an excellent decision on a vice presidential nominee. And if your first test to see if you're going to be a good president is your VP pick, Mr. Trump passed that test. If the second test is the type of candidates that you're going to select or people that you're going to put to be on the Supreme Court, Mr. Trump has put forth some conservative jurors that a lot of people, especially on the Republican side, are proud of. So Mr. Trump is passing these tests as it relates to his fitness and temperament, as it relates to being a good commander-in-chief and good president of the United States. Governor Pence is a good choice. The American people saw that last night, and I believe the Republican Party are proud of the fact that he will be on the ticket supporting Mr. Trump.
Well, I'm with you guys. I am salivating to see how Donald Trump reacts to this for the rest of the day because we know where he starts, which is he tries to come out and, you know, this is I've been saying it's the Kellyanne Conway, he's not as crazy as you think he is tour. So he starts off as something really normal, but he gets poked like a bear, and then before it's over, the claws come out. And so we'll see how he treats Mike Pence after after a day of people saying how great he
did. Well, Jamal, how about on the Democratic side? Because Tim Kaine was said to be somebody who might offset Hillary Clinton, who's more of a policy wonk. He's more personable. He's more, you know, got the rumpled jacket. But he came off as the pit bull. And, you know, as you said, across the board, most analysts are saying that he was a little bit too attacking, a little bit too interrupting. Did he come across as presidential and a good pick last night?
I think Tim Kaine is very presidential. You know, the measurements between Kaine and Pence are really like between, you know, is it 48% or 47% in one direction or the other. Tim Kaine did what he needed to do, which was to prosecute the case against Donald Trump. If he got a little too excited and overheated, charge it to the game. But I think he ultimately did what he came out there to do, which was to push the case against Donald Trump.
And one of the most tweeted things before the debate, about 90 minutes before the debate, the GOP had put out a note saying that Mike Pence won. Maybe they knew something we didn't, given the polling that has happened after this debate. But
I was just going to note, too, that look for the hashtag That Mexican Thing. I don't think that's the last that we've heard of that.
Look for the hashtag Make America Great Again. That's one I'm really looking for.
Harris Dinard, Republican strategist, not working for the Trump campaign. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, not working for the Clinton campaign. Thanks to both of you, as always.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
And we told you earlier this month about an investigation by Reuters that concluded that the U.S. is doing a bad job tracking deaths related to antibiotic-resistant infections or superbugs. One of the reporters, Deb Nelson, told us, for instance, superbug infections are left off death certificates.
But even when they're put on death certificates, they're still not counted because, first of all, states aren't keeping track of them. But also, in our nation's vital statistics, there is no code for antibiotic-resistant infections. So there are 8,000 official causes of death. Not one of them is antibiotic-resistant infections. And that's why, to identify how many people were dying of them, we had to do a special search of the text written on death certificates.
Now, although the exact number of deaths caused by superbugs is unknown, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates 23,000 people die of these infections every year. And CDC officials told us they were disappointed with the Reuters report. They wanted a chance to explain how they're combating the infections. So let's do that with Dr. Beth Bell, director of the CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. She's also the CDC's lead for the implementation of the U.S. National Action Plan to Combat Antibiotic Resistance. Dr. Bell, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And that is one thing that you wanted to make sure was discussed. Now, the Reuters reporters did mention that there was an action plan. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Antibiotic resistance is a really important and serious problem in our country. So the U.S. government has gotten together, and over a period of a year or so, we've put together a national action plan, which lays out a number of areas of things that we need to do to combat antibiotic resistance, to better detect antibiotic resistance, to improve our prevention strategies, to develop new drugs and diagnostics, and to innovate throughout. And so Congress actually funded the government to implement this plan in fiscal year 16. And we at CDC received $160 million for the CDC Solutions Initiative. And that's about certainly better tracking and detecting and responding to outbreaks quickly. But it's also, really importantly, also about prevention. You know, these bacteria are changing all the time. And there are things that we can do now to prevent the spread of resistant bacteria. And this is really what we're focused on at CDC.
Well, Dr. Bell, talk about some of the things that we, as listeners, became aware of. Most states don't require doctors to specify whether MRSA was a factor in a death. Washington and Illinois do. Why isn't it a federal requirement that all hospitals record MRSA or, you know, a superbug in a death?
Well, you know, there are a lot of issues around reporting, about reporting of infections in general. Death reporting is another component of this. It's a state responsibility, this issue of reporting, and it's the states that actually make the rules about reporting in individual states. We at CDC encourage states to report, and actually one of the things that we're doing with the funding that Congress has provided us is to help the states to improve their reporting, not only reporting of deaths, but also reporting of infections, which in many ways we feel is kind of closer to the prevention part of things. You know, I know that a lot of people would think, well, you know, somebody should require this, but The fact of the matter is that the states have responsibility in our system here in this country. And what we do at CDC is to help the states to collect the kind of data that's most important for action. And certainly one component of that is death.
Well, and the reason people are asking, you have the Natalie Silva of El Paso, Texas, mentioned in the Reuters reporting, contracted MRSA after giving birth, died from infection-related complications, and yet her sisters had a fight to get the hospital to even cite MRSA on her death certificate. It was important to them. And
yes.
yet even though they got that, they got it on her death certificate, the Texas Health Department doesn't track deaths from antibiotic-resistant infections, so no one else knows.
Yes. You know, any death from a resistant infection and obviously from many other things is a terrible tragedy. And we at CDC know this very, very well. And we work with many, many patients and patient groups that have some incredibly sad and terrible stories to tell. And there's a number of things that we're doing. For example, one of the groups here at the federal government that does have a lot of kind of regulatory power is CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They have a website which is called Hospital Compare, where anybody can look up and see how any particular hospital is doing on, for example, preventing healthcare-associated infections, on how many cases of MRSA bacteremia have occurred in their hospital.
Well, people can look it up, but what if hospitals aren't accounting? They won't know. In the Reuters story, there was the doctor who signed the death certificate of a little three-year-old and didn't note the infection. He told Reuters he thought it didn't matter. Another doctor said, that's like seeing how sausage is made. People don't need to know that. What do you do about those attitudes, you know, that it doesn't matter? How do you change that?
Well, we can't change everybody's attitude. I think that what we are showing, and I think what we're based on, as I say, is that when you can show that you can do something after you count, that the data doesn't just sit there, but that it's used for action, and it's used for action that helps us to better target prevention strategies, for us to show reductions in resistant bacteria. I think that, you know, to my way of thinking, while we're never going to get everybody to completely understand, and even if you were to mandate something, I think you're never going to get everybody 100% compliance. Mm. You know, my responsibility, frankly, you know, I mean, what keeps me up at night is figuring out how to better target our work to prevent the spread of these infections.
When I read the Reuters article, I found it sympathetic to the CDC. You know, you're being somewhat undercut by hospitals that don't want to sully their reputation by admitting that there had been an infection, that this is a very hard thing, in fact, for you to corral.
I would say that the whole issue of hospitals wanting to cover up, I frankly think that it's getting harder for hospitals to cover up. And actually, some of the funding that we'll be providing with this $160 million will actually improve our ability to detect infections just based on laboratory information. You know, we may get a much better sense of the patterns of antibiotic resistance, again, without having to rely on a doctor putting something down on a report or on a piece of paper.
Dr. Beth Bell, director of the CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. Dr. Bell, thank you.
Sure, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So as she said, track infections directly from lab test results and not from a hospital's written records. You can read the rest of the CDC's plan, the Antibiotic Resistance Solutions Initiative, at hereandnow.org. And staying with health, Georgia has a doctor shortage, as do many states with large rural areas. A recent study by the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute found that two-thirds of the state's counties don't have enough doctors, and most of those counties are rural. So one medical school is trying to target a specific kind of teenager they think might be drawn to small-town medicine, teens who call a small-town home. Michael Caputo of Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
Welcome to med school.
Dr. Jean Sumner is dean at the School of Medicine at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia, and she's making a pitch to a couple of dozen high school students.
We don't have enough applicants from rural Georgia, and we're really trying to look for ways to build up our applicant pool from those areas because those are the kids we want. We need to develop a farm team.
Farm team takes added meaning when you consider these high schoolers come from 4-H clubs in southeast Georgia. It's a first for Mercer and the state 4-H organization, giving rural kids a taste of what it's like to be in medical school. from simulating doctor-patient conversations.
Hi, my name is Dr. Kelly. I'll be helping you out today.
To learning how to test a reflex.
You're hitting the tendon here, okay? Mm-hmm. And then it's... Don't be shy.
After she taps a knee, McKinley Cranford explains her hope to serve her hometown as a pediatrician.
Just helping people that I've always known, and then like my friends, kids, and people like that that come back to Cochrane, that I want to help them.
Laura Harker is a healthcare policy analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. She likes the Mercer 4-H recruitment effort, but...
It's really important to focus on the current issues with rural hospitals and clinics that they're facing with having to care for so many people living in poverty or who are uninsured and not able to pay for care.
Harker says that can leave rural hospitals in shaky financial condition, and that can make setting up a practice in small towns unattractive to doctors. So Mercer is thinking outside the box, seeking out kids who already know rural life really well and hopefully like it enough to want to return home after college. Frank Carter is on the Georgia 4-H Foundation's board of directors. He's also a physician practicing in Waynesboro, population 5,800.
So that is the beauty of this program, and where we hope it sticks, is that you get rural youth that understand small towns and like small towns and will live in a small town.
People like Nick Morrow.
I'm going back home. I'm from a small town in northwest Georgia, and that's where I'm going back to.
Morrow is a medical student at Mercer right now. When he graduates, he says he wants to practice near his home in Cartersville. Morrow says young people in rural areas need help to see what's possible in healthcare.
There's plenty of children in these small towns, just like me, that have the aptitude to do these things. It's just sometimes they don't end up doing that with their life because they don't have a clear path in front of them. Their dads and moms aren't doctors and lawyers. You know, they come from a rural background.
Morrow is just the kind of person Mercer University hopes to find through its collaboration with 4-H. To help, the medical school has set aside a $35 million state grant for scholarships to any medical student, 4-H or not, willing to work in a rural setting after graduation. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Caputo in Macon, Georgia.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
A new study finds the bigger you yawn, the bigger your brain is, whether you're a baby, a man, I don't know if that's real, or a man's best friend. That's a dog. Researchers at the State University of New York at Oneonta are behind the new findings on yawning. And for more, we're joined by Sharon Begley, senior science writer for STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication, and our weekly partner. Hi, Sharon.
Hey, Jeremy.
And I have to say, as I was reading your article about this, I yawned like a million times, not because it wasn't interesting, but because when I saw the word yawn, it made me yawn. But how did this idea to look at yawns and brain size even come about?
Right. So yawning has long been an evolutionary puzzle. It's nearly ubiquitous across the animal kingdom. And whenever biologists see a behavior that is so common, they ask, well, why is that? Did a long ago common ancestor yawn? And every one of us since then has inherited it. And if so, what possible function might it serve? So there have been a lot of theories over the years, and the one that has emerged recently is called the thermoregulatory theory of yawning, which basically means that yawning, when you open up your mouth and suck in air, which usually is colder than, you know, body temperature, It cools the fluid that reaches the brain, and therefore it cools the brain itself, and that allows brains to grow bigger. When brain neurons are active, you know, they emit heat, and they don't function as well if they are overheated. And therefore, this theory has emerged. Yawning is good for the brain.
Yawning is good for the brain. How did the researchers go about figuring that out? I understand that part of it was looking at videos of animal yawns.
Yes, I am happy to tell you that YouTube is now a legitimate scientific resource. It is not just a time suck for funny cat videos. So the researchers at SUNY Oneonta indeed just combed through YouTube for videos of animals yawning. They had mice, they had dogs, they had cats, they had camels and walruses and people and African elephants and capuchin monkeys and more than you can possibly imagine. They had nearly 200 animals across a couple of dozen species. And somebody's got to do it, Jeremy. So they just sat there with a stopwatch and they just timed how long various animals yawned. And they had several animals of each species. They averaged them. They came up with a number. So as you would imagine, an animal with a tiny mouth, like a mouse, its average yawn is 0.8 seconds. People, 6.5 seconds. But interestingly, the time of the yawn did not precisely track the size of the mouth, which you think would have to do with the size of the brain. There were differences, and they found that it was the length of the yawn, more than size of the mouth or other things, that best correlated with the weight of the brain and the number of neurons in the cortex, which is the part that does higher order thinking.
Did this make you think differently about how you yawn?
Yes, it made me think I should just leave off the coffee and just yawn a whole lot more, and I would be a much smarter person.
That's Sharon Begley, senior science writer for our partners at STAT. We'll link you to more of this at hereandnow.org, maybe even a cat and dog video up there, maybe a tiny mouse yawn. Sharon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
And joining us today is Liza Richardson, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. She's also a film and TV music supervisor. Liza, welcome.
Hey, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. And by the way, what does that mean to be a TV and film music supervisor?
Yeah, I work in film and TV, and I'm creatively helping the filmmakers figure out what they want and then making sure everything gets cleared within a budget, that kind of thing. Mm.
But you're picking the music that we hear when we watch these things.
Cool. I'm helping to pick it, yeah.
Wow. All right, well, let's get to some of the music that you brought us today. This is the Mexican band Café Tacuba. This is Un Par de Lugares. Tell us about this one.
This is a band that I've loved since the mid-90s. I have some history with them because I tried to get them signed at Geffen Records back then, and I worked with them on the film Y Tu Mama También. And the composer, Gustavo Santaolalla, he was my guest DJ around that time in the mid-90s, and he turned me on to so many bands from Latin America, and it kind of changed my life and my career. And many of those bands he produced, now he focuses mostly on score composition. But he still produces all of the bands, all of Café Tacuba's records. They're from Mexico City. Amazing, legendary artist, great band. And in this one, I just love the progression that they're making. Big keyboards, just layers upon layers of keyboards. Great song from Café Tacuba.
It almost sounds like the Latin U2.
In this song, it does. But, you know, other songs of theirs sound traditional or like polka or like ska or some of the other beautiful rock songs. A lot of great pop music that they've created. But you're right. That one does sound, a little bit like you, too.
Well, let's get to the next one. This is the L.A. artist Cuesta Loeb, and this is My King.
Hanging your boots off of the bed, ready to run out of the world into your head.
Almost a 90s alternative rock sound there.
Yeah, totally. Kind of a dream pop, a big lush sound with giant guitars. But it starts out with these beautiful, sweet ukuleles. And I just love the progression of this song, the way it moves. She comes from a family of musicians. And this woman, Cuesta Loeb, just moved to the Los Feliz area. And she has found a completely different voice. She grew up more in a classical environment. And now she's doing something different. It sounds fresh.
The Los Feliz area, by the way, for people who don't know, that's a neighborhood of Los Angeles. And I also congratulate you on saying ukulele the way that you're supposed to say it. We interviewed the great ukulele player, Jake Shimabukuro, and that is why
great.
I know to say ukulele.
Well, I work on the show Hawaii Five-O. So I'm one of the guys that works with me in my office is from Maui, so we're big on correct Hawaiian pronunciation, even though I still mess it up a little bit.
Well, you did a very good job there. Let's get to the next one. This is Gus Geeter. This is I'm Tired of Being Alone.
I'd do anything for your love if you come back to me. Yeah. I can't live without you anymore. Oh, no, no. I'm tired of being alone. Why don't you come back home? Come back home, girl. You and me together forever. Hey, 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 hey.
I like that a lot. And it's a very sort of familiar sound for some reason.
I know. I can't put my finger on it. But it's something that apparently came out in 2012. But to me, it sounds more like 1979.
Yeah.
But I just found it. So let's call it new. The question is it soul? Is it disco, Memphis blues, or country? I'm just not sure. But I just love this feeling. It's sort of lo-fi, unpolished, and it definitely gets me in the party spirit.
Okay, well, up next, we have the Seattle group Dude York with Tonight.
I was at the bottom, dreaming of the top of the pond. The rain dropped and it shook my whole world apart. Went for a swim just to see if he was out there to find. I'm sure he's there, but seems like all he ever does is hide. If he were like me, we could be happy. But clearly we're too different. I guess that means it's the end. The way you talk to me makes me feel like just a friend. I might be wrong, but at least I'm sure that you're not.
Heavy pop is this group's description on its Facebook page. What do you like?
Well, okay, so this one comes out early next year. A little advance on this one. The drummer of this band is the son of my parents' general doctor in Idaho, Dr. Hall. Mm. And he asked me to check out his son's band, which happens a lot. And my expectations are usually pretty kind of, you know, low in this situation. But these guys just rocked my world. Loud, brash, noisy. Dude York, they're a lot of fun. I don't know. They're great.
And Dude York, not a band that everyone has heard of.
Not yet, and hopefully you will, but this is the kind of band that's a perfect example. There's so many bands these days that have to do everything themselves. All their own social networking, all their publicity, their radio, their sync pursuits, merchandising. It's really challenging. So any help that they can get along the way, you know, hopefully they grow and grow and grow. But I think they've got what it takes. I think they've got a great sound.
All right. Well, the last one we have here, I am very excited about as somebody who used to live in Los Angeles and listen to the person who this band is named after. Let's get to the music first. This is Cherry Glazer. That's the name of the band with Told You I'd Be With the Guys. Now, Cherry Glazer is, in addition to being the name of this band, the name of one of the hosts on KCRW.
That's right. That's why we've always loved them from the get-go, because they named themselves after our esteemed host of Morning Edition. Isn't that, I know, we love
amazing.
That. We love that. I always tease Cherry about it when I see her. And this band, they're from L.A., and their tunes were fun from the beginning. But judging from this new song, there is so much buzz on these guys. They just got an insane, great review from Pitchfork. And it sounds like they're taking this whole rock career thing pretty seriously. And I can't wait to hear these guys on a bill with the likes of Wolf Alice or The Kills or Pale Honey or something like that.
And another sound of kind of this alternative rock sound, is it coming back? Are we going back into the kind of 90s grunge days?
I don't know. My set list today may argue that. But I find it difficult to find these awesome, crunchy, great-sounding indie rock bands, because sometimes bands can't really afford to sound great, and sometimes they just nail it. But, you know, that's a good question, and I've actually had that conversation with that band, Dude York. Is indie rock coming back or not? I don't know. But I love it, personally.
It's Liza Richardson, a DJ at KCRW, and also, as we've heard there, a film and TV music supervisor in Hollywood. Liza, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. We are NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Iraq launched a new radio station this week, broadcasting to people living in Mosul. That's Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, recorded by BBC Monitoring, telling the people of Mosul, "We will celebrate a big victory of Mosul with you soon. We will raise the flag of Iraq in the center of Mosul." Now, the Iraqi flag, if raised, would replace the black flag of ISIS, which has flown, at least figuratively, over Iraq's second largest city since the summer of 2014, after ISIS swept across Iraq and Syria, taking control of large swaths of both, declaring a caliphate. Now, ISIS has lost much of that territory since then. Iraqi troops, aided by the Kurds and U.S. airstrikes, have retaken several cities, including Fallujah and Ramadi. And now, the long-awaited offensive to retake Mosul is expected to begin soon. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. He joins us from Washington. And Phil, how soon do we know? Because we're hearing this drumbeat.
That's a great question. The attack against Mosul has been just around the corner for about 18 months now, and there's been discussion about shaping operations and buildups and troop deployments and so forth for quite a while. This could actually be it. We heard the prime minister talking to the people of Mosul there. There have been other kind of anecdotal indicators that something could be happening soon, but right now we do not have an actual date certain for you to circle on the calendar for when it will begin.
Well, just a quick political question for you, because that Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, as you know, has criticized the Obama administration for giving ISIS a heads up, you know, saying we're going to be doing this. Is that a legitimate criticism, or is there a purpose to saying this?
There's a purpose to saying it, and there are two worlds in which the Pentagon and the U.S. operate in terms of these battlefield practices. There's the public world, which is what we hear the president, the secretary of defense, the secretary of state, and other officials talk about, all of which is very programmed and calculated, and there's a method to the madness. And then there's the actual preparations that are taking place behind the scenes, almost none of which we know about or hear about except what occasionally bubbles to the surface. If the Americans are signaling and warning, it's because they want, most likely, the ISIS fighters who have been safeguarding Mosul for so long to start to get away if they can, to minimize as much as possible what could be, in a worst-case scenario, a Stalingrad-like battle royale that takes place there once these Iraqi forces, with significant American help, finally launch their offensive.
Get them to run away first. Now, President Obama announced recently that the U.S. is deploying an additional 600 troops to Iraq to assist in this offensive. He's saying they're not combat troops, but the phrase slippery slope always comes up when you hear that U.S. troops are going to be advisors. What's the sense of what they will do?
The Iraqis need a lot of help on the aspects of running a military that do not include the actual combat with the enemy, although clearly they've needed a lot of training and assistance with that, too. They need help fusing intelligence from spies and aircraft and intercepts. They need help getting things beans, bullets, and band-aids and so forth to forward positions so their fighters can use them in combat, and they need a lot of help from the air. And so the more than 5,000 American troops in Iraq and Syria today do those type of support jobs, although to be clear, they are also actually in contact with the enemy. They are releasing their weapons. They're shooting ordnance downrange. They're dropping missiles and bombs from their aircraft, clearly. And so even though the administration doesn't like to call it combat because that makes people uncomfortable, at least it makes them uncomfortable, there is some of that to the American presence there in both countries.
And always dangerous. What's the sense of what the fighting force will be like? We hear Iraqi troops, but also Kurds. Turkey's leader is saying, we're going to come and help too, even though they're being told, no, you're not. Who's waging this battle?
There's a lot of three-dimensional chess taking place in the Middle East right now. The Turks, for their part, are nervous about the degree to which the U.S. has strengthened pan-Kurdish forces across Syria and Iraq. The Iraqis don't have as much an interest in fighting that far north with the government forces, but the U.S. really wants Baghdad to be a strong federal state and have the former borders of Iraq endure throughout this conflict. And so all those forces are playing out at the same time as these Iraqi commanders with American help decide who actually will be in that force that does the attack. I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that question right now, but those are the factors that people are assessing as we get closer to the day, whenever it is.
And can we guess what the fighting might be like? Some are saying house to house, like the battle for Fallujah during the Iraq War, one of the bloodiest fighting for U.S. Marines in that war in 2004. And who's there? You know, when people are speaking to the people of Fallujah, I mean, rather Mosul, who's left?
Well, there are many civilians who could not get out for whatever reason. They've been living under the lash of this extremist so-called government since 2014, as you talked about at the top. And there are many ISIS fighters there, too. And in a best-case scenario, they could decide it's not worth it. They don't want to fight to the end, and they want to get out of the city and keep their force in being to fight elsewhere. And in a worst-case scenario, it could be one of those nightmare scenarios where there is house-to-house fighting in the U.S., as it had to do in other places like Ramadi, Fallujah, Tikrit, some of these other cities, might have to basically destroy the city in order to save it, although no one hopes that happens.
Well, and you said the U.S., you know, underscoring again that while it's Iraqi and Kurdish troops on the ground, U.S. in the air, and perhaps, you know, on the perimeter. Phil Ewing, NPR's national security editor. Phil, thanks as always. We'll keep an eye on this. The retaking of Mosul scheduled to happen soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Phil. Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.